So I want to thank Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring the series Great Jewish Challenges. Tonight is part one. It's sponsored Le'il Nishmat Yona Ben Harav Aryeh Leib. I'm not embarrassed to say that this series borrowed the idea from the latest book published by Rabbi Wein entitled, is a good plug, Struggles and Challenges and Tradition, How Jewish Communities Defended Orthodoxy from 1820 to 1940. The book entails a lot of the challenges that Jews faced during that period of 120 years, intellectual, religious, cultural challenges, and my idea actually was to rewind several centuries and begin in late medieval times, examining how the Torah world responded to the challenges of the day, the Renaissance, false messiahs, secularism, etc., and how they affect us until today, and really how echoes of those challenges and responses are still with us today as well. So tonight is part one, and we're going to look at the printing press and the astonishing influence it had on the world and on Jewish life in particular. And it is surprising, but according to many historians, the invention of the printing press transformed the world. So what exactly did Johannes Gutenberg do? Gutenberg, years 1400 to 1468, was a German. I should tell you that as I did my research, there are Jews who claim that he was Jewish. Obviously, because we assume that anyone who's done anything productive in the world must be Jewish. But Gutenberg was not Jewish at all. He was a German born in Mainz, and he worked mainly as a goldsmith. And to be clear, he did not invent the printing press. The printing press was already extant in China for several centuries. What he did invent, at least in Europe around the year 1440, was the printing press with movable type. Now, apparently that also existed in China, but certainly not as sophisticated as Gutenberg had. What's the printing press with movable type? It means that the letters were manufactured in a metal matrix, easily adjustable using a hand mold, and it was first hooked up to a screw press such as was used in wine or olive oil production. And Gutenberg also developed a special type of oil-based ink that made his printing very clear, very legible. Gutenberg's press could produce up to 3,600 pages a day, which is actually astonishing when you compare it to what came the day before he invented it, where everything was written by hand. As a result of Gutenberg, books could be mass-produced, even though it even took him one day to design one page. So to get a sense of what exactly he did, a rumor has it that he stumbled upon this invention by accident, like many great inventions. See, he was experimenting, as the story goes, with melding blocks of letters into words when his child ran into his workshop and knocked everything over. It was then that Gutenberg realized that we much simpler keep the letters separate, and so it was, meaning his original plan was to just make these blocks of words and reassemble the words, and then he realized how much simpler it would be just to have each letter separate and build the matrix from the letters, and so it was. His first book was what came to be known as the Gutenberg Bible, of which fewer than 200 copies were published. Gutenberg's Bible featured 42 lines of script, and obviously became a collector's item in centuries past. It's still around, they're scattered about the world, each one today. There are only a relative handful that are full Bibles, some are partial Bibles, but the ones that are full are worth a small fortune, about $30 million. One was last seen in the New York City Public Library down on 42nd Street. Sadly for Gutenberg, as often happens, he got ensnared in a legal dispute with his primary investor, another German named Johann Fust, who accused Gutenberg of misusing the invested funds. The court ruled in favor of Fust, and Gutenberg lost his printing shop, but apparently he was able to retain another smaller one. Nevertheless, Gutenberg went bankrupt and never really cashed in on his invention, and it was Fust who took Gutenberg's invention and marketed it. And yet, Gutenberg's legacy is secure long after his death. He's widely considered to be one of the most influential people ever. In fact, A&E, the cable station America, in 1997 ran bios, as the millennium was ending, of the greatest people of the millennium, meaning the most influential, transformative people, and they ranked Gutenberg number one. And really, the world was different, pre-Gutenberg and post-Gutenberg, as we'll explain. And one of his enduring legacies is the University of Mainz, we call Magenta, a famous city in Germany along the Rhine, which is named the Gutenberg University of Mainz. Mass printing spread like wildfire. Within a few decades, there are printing presses all across Europe, from London to Krakow, from Sweden to Italy. The major centers of printing were first in Germany, but it was soon surpassed by those in Italy, which had presses in many major cities and towns. So the church used it, of course. One of the earliest mass-produced documents were indulgences sold by the church, but the church also feared that it would lose control over the dissemination of information and thus influence over its subjects. This should sound very familiar to us, because it is the plaint, fear, and obsession of every dictator that they'll lose control over information, which might lead to, who knows, freedom, or worse, a revolution. Control of printing and or the means of communication became indispensable to the creation of any police state. So in more recent times, coups are effectuated by capturing the leader and simultaneously seizing the radio and television stations, sometimes newspapers as well. So the communists, especially in the Soviet Union, they were fanatics about controlling printing, which gave rise to samizdats, which were underground publications that dissidents shared with each other. The refuseniks, the Jewish refuseniks, later used that also to disseminate Hebrew language and Torah thoughts, etc. But they ran it on their own mimeograph machines, that, and thus they were able to spread their influence, albeit in a much more limited way. This is why China, for example, has barred a free press, most recently in Hong Kong, which has unfortunately joined the ranks of the unfree. So it's clear that Gutenberg's invention was a mixed blessing for rulers and for the ruled as well. Within 50 years, millions of books had been printed and distributed across the civilized world. It was now a new world, and it's very hard to turn back once you encounter a new world. Nevertheless, there's always something captivating about hand-printed books, manuscripts. Think of the time, for example, that it takes a sofer to write a Sefer Torah letter by letter. It could take anywhere from 6-7 months to 12 months, depending on his talent and speed. I remember I visited a few years ago the library, famous library at Trinity College in Dublin, where they have on display the Book of Kells, the first four books of the New Testament, illustrated and calligraphed by monks and completed about the year 800. So the colors and the penmanship are still striking, more than 12 centuries later. But the printing press effected a revolution that is comparable to the Industrial Revolution, the Transportation Revolution, and the Digital Revolution in our own day. So what were some of the reactions to it, and especially how did it come to our world? Well, one unanticipated consequence of the printing press with movable type was an immediate increase in Jew hatred, in pogroms and blood libels, especially in Germany. What was considered to be modern and sophisticated pretty quickly proved to be an effective tool in unleashing the world's oldest hatred and spreading the word of Jewish nefariousness far beyond the locale of any particular accusation. So it was able to get people riled up very easily. If this sounds familiar, it should, because the internet was and is a boon in many ways and for many people, but it is also for Jew haters who now find like-minded haters instantly and can more easily coordinate their assaults. If you think of the well-deserved tzarot of Kanye West of the last few weeks, so this is not possible without an internet and mass and instant communication. With the printing press, ideas could be circulated to a broader audience in a relatively short amount of time. So it's not only the words that were used to spread these accusations against Jews, it was also images. Churches could receive and disseminate pictures, and they did, drawings in the 15th century, of Jews with bloody knives holding Christian children about to slaughter them, like the blood libel of the killing of Simon Trent, which became one of the familiar depictions of Jews in the 15th century, or Jews eating the wafer, which they call desecrating the host, or pictures of Jews as pigs, as well as images of Jews being burnt alive, which was even more than just suggestive thinking. Local events became very quickly county and provincial and the national events, and the tales escalated in gravity with each retelling. And I'm here summarizing the research of Amy O'Callaghan at Oberlin College, who quite remarkably uncovered this not well-known facet of Gutenberg's invention. So in the last half of the 15th century, meaning the half century after Gutenberg's printing press with movable type was popularized, and at the same time that Jews were being pressured and persecuted in Spain, Jews were expelled from many German cities, such as Mainz, or Endingen, or Mecklenburg, or Nuremberg, and other cities, after ritual murder and host desecration accusation. And all this was before the Reformation and the hatred released by Martin Luther. So what would happen is there'd be an accusation of a blood libel in one town, and it would just spread across Germany. And if Jews were evicted from one village and went to another, pretty quickly this village not only had accounts of what the Jews allegedly did, but they also had pictures, drawings, even songs were composed with the lyrics shared widely. And it became a very handy, convenient mechanism for sharing any type of allegations against the Jews. So Jews were then attacked for being wealthy, and Jews were attacked for being parasites. Much like in the early 20th century, Jews were attacked for being communists, and Jews were being attacked for being capitalists. Christians who were accused of crimes simply blamed the Jews for it, and the stories of Jewish malevolence spread even before the Jews knew what was happening. So this problem always existed. It existed in early medieval times, but it had a much more limited scope. The printing press gave it life, vibrancy, transmission, wide transmission, proliferation across a much greater territorial area. Now, for all the problems then that the printing press caused the church, and it did cause a lot of problems, knowledge became democratized. People were more difficult to control. Without Gutenberg, there's no Protestant Reformation. The church also benefited from it financially and, of course, in its capacity when it wanted to foment Jewish hatred. For Jews, that aspect of the printing press was a losing battle and really a negative that we had to deal with. But conversely, Jews quickly realized that the printing press was a shield against one of the medieval scourges, and that was book burning. Think of the harm, for example, that was wrought by King Louis IX, egged on by Pope Gregory IX, June 17th, 1242, after the calumnies against the Talmud of the apostate Nicholas Donin, before and after the disputation in Paris. So we know, as Erev Shabbat Parshat Chukat, every copy of the Talmud in France, that's roughly 12,000 manuscripts, all handwritten, 24 cartloads, were burnt in the square near the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, that almost 8 centuries later had its own fire. So this tragedy of the massive book burning in France was memorialized, as we know, by the Maharam Rutenberg, Rav Meir of Rutenberg, a prime student of the Rush, entitled Sha'ali Srufa Ba'esh, Seek Out the Welfare of the Jews, You Who Are Burnt in Fire. And it's one of the more emotional keynote that we read every Tisha B'Av. And this crime essentially ended the year of the Balei Tosfot in France, because there were no copies of the Talmud that were left. Louis, of course, as we know, became a saint. St. Louis, the home of the Cardinals, who were defeated by the Phillies just a few weeks ago. So fast forward now 200 years, and suddenly book burning is much less effective. It was still done. We'll see in a moment massive burnings of the Talmud in Rome and Venice in the early 1550s. But the consequences of those book burnings were relatively short-lived. As long as Jews could print more books, Jewish life and Jewish scholarship and study of Torah could endure. So when the church cracked down on publishing of the Talmud in Italy, printers in Constantinople and Salonika, and in Lublin, and in Amsterdam, and in Frankfurt, they took up the slack. So how then did Jewish printing get its start? Well, Jewish printing, as we can imagine, followed Gentile printing very closely. And the first Jewish printing was in Italy, in Padua, in Naples, and in Reggio, which is in Calabria, where Abraham Gartone printed Rashi's commentary on Chumash, without the Chumash, in 1475. It's widely held to be the first Jewish book ever published, although there was another book that people think was published earlier, but it's undated and therefore can't be proven. It was Gartone, by the way, who invented, really borrowed, what became known as Rashi's script, because it was used for Rashi's commentary to distinguish it from the Chumash. So obviously Rashi never used it, but it was called Rashi's script because that's the script in which they published Rashi's commentary. And Gartone, a Sfardi, modeled it somewhat after Arabic cursive script. And if you look at the letters of Rashi, you see it's not, of course, like Arabic, but it bears a lot of similarity to Arabic. Most of the letters are similar to Ketav Ashurit, the Ketav in which we write a Sefer Torah, but not all, like the Aleph or the Shin. In effect, Jewish children learn Hebrew in two different fonts, with some different styles of letters. And this script continued to be used, is still used today, when Rashi is printed with the Chumash, or Rashi in the Gemara. One of the earliest publications also was the Ramban's commentary on the Chumash, also published without the Chumash. Around the same time, the Tur was published. The Tur is the commentary of Yaakov Balaturim, was the son of the Rush. Of course, without the Beit Yosef or the Bach, neither of whom was alive yet. This is printed by another Jewish printer, Meshulam Kusi, also Italian. And of course, there's an Italian town that we made famous because of the family that lived there and took its name from the town, and that's the town of Sansino, which is about an hour's drive east of Milan. Yisrael Sansino, his son Yoshua Sansino, and Yoshua's nephew Gershom Sansino became very prominent printers, with Gershom the most successful of all of them, printing about 100 different Sfarim before the year 1500. And it was Sansino that produced the first Gemara, just one Masechta Brachot, in 1483. So Sansino had the best quality printing and became the most famous, and it spread across the continent to Turkey, and then in 1557 to Cairo, just as well, because for decades in the mid-16th century, printing Jewish books was banned in Italy. Within a short time, a very short time, the church authorities banned Jews from owning printing presses. It was considered too great an exercise of freedom and autonomy. But even to that, Jews adjusted fairly quickly. We have to remember that Venice, for all its charms today when people visit, persecuted its Jews, and in fact the Venetians were pioneers in different aspects, different facets of Jew hatred. They made Jews wear yellow garments, yellow hats, right, that already exists in the 13th century also, but in the early 1500s they confined the Jews to a ghetto. A ghetto is an Italian word meaning foundry, which is a narrow area in which Jews were confined every night. But Jews lived there, and one of the most famous so-called Jewish printers, really the first famous one in Venice, was a Gentile named Daniel Bamberg, originally from Antwerp, a businessman from a family of businessmen who saw a market for Jewish books in Venice. So in 1515, after paying the appropriate bribes to local officials, and you know, they were honest politicians, honest meaning when bought, they stay bought. He did that, and once that was done, he hired 4 Jewish assistants and got to work. His first major publication was the Mikraot Gedolot, which exists today, which is the Chumash surrounded by different commentaries. This was so influential because for the most part, the format and choice of commentaries in the Mikraot Gedolot remain the same until today. Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, of course, the Sfarta lived during that period in the early part of the 16th century in Italy. So he got his Perush in, and others over time. How influential was it? It was Bamberg and the Jews who worked for him who organized the division of the Tanakh into chapters, prakim. Before then, the Tanakh, the Chumash, were just parshiot, and the parshiot were not numbered. They were the ones who divided Shmuel, the book of Shmuel, and the book of Malachim, and Divrei Hayamim, into 2 books. They set the standard for what commentaries were published. Now, in 1523, the first complete Talmud, meaning he would produce a Masechet every year or so, the first complete Talmud was published by Bamberg in Venice, with Rashi on one side, in the inner side of the page, Tosfot on the outside of the page, on the other side of the Gemara, which is the format until today. So again, it was not published in the order of the Talmud. The first one he published was Psachim, and it was usually sold as individual Masechtot, but over the course of 8 years or so, he came up with he produced the entire Talmud. And they also determined the pagination of the Talmud. Until then, there was no such thing as, those who started Bet Amud Aleph, there's no such thing as Yud Amud Aleph, Yud Amud Bet. In the Rishonim, like the Ran or the Ramban, you find that when they quote a Gemara, they'll recite the Masechet, they'll recite the Perek, the chapter it's in by name, you know, Elu Mevarchin, but never the page number, because they didn't have page numbers. If they're nice, They'll write at the beginning or middle or end of a particular chapter. But since most of it was memorized, there were manuscripts, but not that many, it was assumed that if you told someone where to find it in the Perek, they would find it right away quite easily in a manuscript. And while Sansino only published 16 Masechtot, Bamberg published the entire Shas. This was a tremendous boon for Talmud Torah, for Talmid Chachamim, for many reasons: availability, ease of discussion, but particularly because they came up with a novel idea. Earlier, when Mefarshim were published, like Rashi, Tosfot, they're always printed separately, not in the Gemara itself. So think of learning Gemara, and you want to see Rashi, open up a different book. You want to see Rambam, still a different book. The Tosfot, different book. But here, they decided to put it side by side, which made learning much easier. It was an historic transformation. Within just a few decades, Bamberg printed a whole entire Mishnah, a Yerushalmi, without any Mefarshim, Midrashim, the Mishnah Torah, the Tur, Chuvot of the Truman Adeshin and the Rashba, and many others as well. Not bad for a Gentile. And it's even odder, because Bamberg was convinced to enter the Jewish publishing business by Felice de Prato, who was an apostate Jew who had become an Augustinian friar. The two of them we have to give a lot of thanks to, because they really revolutionized the study of Torah. Moreover, Bamberg paid the church for the right to be the exclusive publisher of the Talmud and other works, and so he produced uncensored editions. He strenuously resisted any attempt by the church to modify or delete what it perceived as anti-Christian references. It was after he died in 1549, the book burning started shortly thereafter, and when it resumed, that's when the censorship of different Talmudic passages started. But you could look in the original copies of Bamberg's editions, and the people do this, and they see what the original text was, and that's why the most modern editions of the Talmud, printed today, the last couple of decades, they have the original texts restored to what they were when it was edited by Ravina and Ravashi. Printing was also profitable. After all, Bamberg was a businessman, and such a profitable business, like moth to a flame, is going to naturally attract competitors and litigation. So Q, Marco Antonio Giustiniani, was a native Venetian from a prominent patrician family. In 1545, Giustiniani opened his own printing shop near the bridge of the Rialto in Venice, and he began to produce his own Talmud. And it was an exquisitely produced edition, and he included what are today familiar indexes, such as the Ein Mishpat, or the Ner Mitzvah, that shows on the top of the Talmud, usually on the right side of the page, the reference of a particular Gemara statement, where it's quoted in the Tur, where it's quoted in the Rambam, the Masoret HaShas, showing where statements in the Talmud appear elsewhere in the Talmud. How did Giustiniani come to this? It's because the author of those indexes, Rabbi Yeshua Boaz Baruch, was also Venetian, and he worked for Giustiniani. Giustiniani needed something to distinguish his edition from that of Bamberg. Later, Rabbi Yeshua Boaz Baruch would add the Torah Or, which gives the source for every pasuk cited in the Talmud. He was also the author of the Shulta Giborim on the Rif, clearly a first-rate Talmud Chacham. He didn't live a long life. I think he died in his 40s, but just think about the genius involved. You know, no computer, no internet, no Bar Ilan CD-ROM, nothing. Just being able to look at a Gemara and saying, this is the source in the Tur, this is the source in the Rambam. Seeing a Gemara and saying, this is cited 3, 4, 5 other places in the Talmud, and recording each one. Looking at a Pasuk and saying, I know this Pasuk is going to be found in Yeshayo, in Perek Memvav. It's an astonishing bit of wisdom. Rav Yeshua Boaz Baruch later became the editor of another edition of the Talmud, printed in another Italian town, Sabbioneta. Giustiniani's edition was so beautiful that the cover page had a picture of the Beit HaMikdash with an inscription from the Navi Haggai, Gadol Yeh Kavod HaBait HaZacharon Min HaRishon Amar Hashem Tzvakot, that the glory of this house, the later house, is greater than the original one, and that became his symbol, known as a printer's mark. He was the first to use it, Giustiniani, and all his books carried them, and thereafter, every publisher has his own symbol that he puts on the title page as well. Well, as we can imagine, success breeds problems, and especially litigation. So, around this time, we're talking about the late 1840s, Rav Meir Katzenelenbogen, famous, the Maharam of Padua, that was the Rav of Padua in Italy, and by proximity of Venice as well, he published the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, the Arach HaZakeh, in 1850, with his own commentary added to it, through another Gentile publishing house, that of Alvis Bragadini, who was a rival of Giustiniani. So Giustiniani, who saw himself as Bragadini's competitor but superior, then duplicated that Mishneh Torah, including the commentary of Maharam of Padua, which led to litigation that was brought by the Maharam of Padua against Giustiniani. Well, where is a Jew going to sue a Gentile? Nowhere. So I call it litigation somewhat whimsically. It was actually a Shaila question that the Maharam of Padua sent to the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, in Krakow. Rama happened to be a cousin, a distant cousin of the Maharam, which is not the best look, but it was a Shaila more than it was a trial. And he asked for a psak. What should be the fate of the Giustiniani edition of the Mishneh Torah, which just copied what the Maharam of Padua had published? Well, the Rama ruled that the Giustiniani edition of the Mishneh Torah violated the laws of Gezel, theft, to which Gentiles are also subject, one of the Noahide laws, violated the dinim of Hasagat Gvul, which exists in the Talmud in terms of boundary markers, but now became a source for copyright infringement as well. And the Rama, in his decision, banned Jews from purchasing the cheaper Giustiniani edition until the Maharam's work was completely sold out. The first edition was sold out, and so the Maharam would be able to recoup his investment. Now, the Rambam based his decision on existing notions of Hasagat Gvul in the Talmud, on the mitzvah to help a Talmud Chacham earn a living, and the need for accuracy in printing because of the danger of misprints, and he held that the Maharam was much more punctilious than was Giustiniani. So Rama writes, you can read the whole story, it's in the Shut of the Rama in Siman Yud, number 10, and the Rama says, V'kolshkenu de'ikr ma'ashonu poskim u'mitalmud ashar sifri mecharbim, we paskim based on the Talmud and other authors as well, v'miya sefer mut'eh, if there are any errors in the sefer, the book, b'kal yavo l'dot bedin, lesor hamutar, u'lahatira asur, if there's a mistake in the book, it'll just lead poskim to make mistakes, saying something is mutter when it's asur, something is permitted and it's forbidden, or to say something is pure when it's impure. The implication was the Giustiniani work could not be relied on. Now, of course, it was assumed that Giustiniani would not and could not be bound by the decision of the Rama. The Rama could not enforce it. He had no divisions at his disposal, and therefore applied only to Jews. And the Rama's ruling was actually quite limited, because he said only the Jews of Poland could not buy Giustiniani's work. Nonetheless, the Rama assumed that there would be no untoward consequences for ruling against a Gentile, because then, at least in Poland, where the Rama lived in Krakow, Jews were protected by the king. Well, not so in Italy. Giustiniani appealed to the church, which, the ruling on a dispute between Giustiniani and Bragadini, decided to rule against the both of them, and they took all the volumes in dispute and all the copies of the Talmud that were extant, and in a mass conflagration on Rosh Hashanah in the year 1555 in the Campo di Fiori in Rome, they burnt everything. Soon, very soon, this papal decree was extended to Venice, which did not resume Hebrew publishing until 1563, but the very next year, 1554, the Pope modified his order. If I recall correctly, that was the year of three popes. So the Pope who ordered the burning was not the Pope who changed the order, but the Pope allowed Jewish publishing to resume as long as the text was approved by a Jewish censor. And this continued in some capacity, and not only the church, the Tsar and others, for the next four centuries. And that became a profession for apostate Jews, finding cryptic, enigmatic, and sometimes fanciful references to Christianity in the Talmud where they didn't exist, and excising them or changing the words. Another enduring outcome of this was that the rabbis of Italy, to preclude these types of copyright disputes, then decreed in the 1550s that all Sfarim must carry the approbation of at least three rabbis or communal leaders listed on the title page as guarantors that the particular book does not infringe on anyone's rights and it is therefore worthy of purchase. This has been enshrined in the practice of haskamot that adorn almost every book. So haskamot today are not guaranteeing against copyright infringement. It's just a sign that somebody looked at the book, maybe even read it, and said, yeah, this is a good book, buy it. Mass printing made theft of intellectual property achievable. So books began to be prefaced with all sorts of warnings. Remember, all we had were manuscripts. If you copied a manuscript, it really had limited ability of dissemination. Not so in printing. So take this for example. It's in the introduction to the Torah Tmima. He covers all bases. Torah was published in the early part of the 20th century. He said, Zchut hadfasa sefer zeh kulo lihu. The right of printing this book is all mine. Ve'in reshut l'chol adam v'chol ha'olam l'atfiso b'lo reshuti reshut b'nei beiti. No one has the right to publish anything of my work without my permission or that of my family. B'chol ofen v'tafnishu any form or manner. Afilu b'lo achumash. Even without the chumash, you can't take the commentary of the Torah. To me, what he did is he listed all the Talmudic references in the psukim and gave a little commentary on it. He said, even that you can't print. Afilu rakovetz hadrasha levadi, even to summarize what I said, you can't do. Afilu rak sefer echad mechamesha chumashim, even just printing one chumash, that you can't do. Ogam megillah levadon, even at the megillot you can't do, even each megillah alone. V'overal ze milvad sheyavol din ha-Torah basagat gvul, od yamod bedin al pi chukei ha-medinot. And anyone who violates this and breaches my copyright, he's not only violating the Torah law of infringement, hasagat gvul, but he'll have to answer to the local non-Jewish authorities as well. All right, that's a very strong statement against any type of theft of intellectual property. But the printing press, Gutenberg's invention, now engendered other halacha considerations as well. One of them was owning books, which was not common, but yet one of the earliest and lingering expressions of the difference between calligraphed and printed works is the famous comment of the Rosh that is cited by the Shulchan Aruch in Reish Ayin in Yoredeya on the last mitzvah in the Torah, Ktivat Sefer Torah. So the 613th commandment is every Jew is commanded to write a Sefer Torah. So the Rosh said that this commandment, writing a Sefer Torah, only applied in the early generations because they would write a Sefer Torah and people would learn from that. It wasn't meant for reading in shul. It was meant so a parent could teach a child chumash. Aval ho'idna, but the Rosh said these days, he's talking the 1300s, shekotun Sefer Torah minichan ad beit ha'knesset legrobim barabim. Now they just write a Sefer Torah and put it in the Aron HaKodesh, Now, mitzvat aseh kol Yisrael, asher yado maseg lichtov chumshei haTorah, mishnah, gemara, perishayim, lagot bem hu avanav. Now the Rosh said, the mitzvah of writing a sefer Torah was not stam to produce a chefzah shel sefer Torah, it was rather to produce something that you'd be able to learn Torah from. So since we don't learn Torah from a Sefer Torah anymore, the 613th commandment of Torah is not to write or own a Sefer Torah, but to own Svarim. Chumash, a Mishnah, a Talmud, etc. He says, the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah, kadei lilmod ba, va'anao al yidei ha-gemara, perisha, yeda perisha mitzvah, va'adinam al-buryam, l'chein, hein ha-svarim, shodim etzuvah l'kotvam. Since the, again, the Rosh said, since the mitzvah is to write, not write, but really learn from it, if we're not learning from a scroll, we're not performing any mitzvah simply by writing a Sefer Torah. The mitzvah is to acquire Svarim. This notion of the Rosh became quite popular in the ensuing centuries. Most Jews did not have the capacity to write a Sefer Torah, of course. What do? They bought Svarim and thereby fulfilled the mitzvah according to the Rosh. Many questions arose. Firstly, as you can imagine, is printing considered writing? So for example, could a Sefer Torah be printed? Make it a lot easier, a lot cheaper. If a Torah is printed, could you read from the Sefer Torah? So the Bach says, no. It's in Tofresh Sadi Aleph. Avol bechumashin shalonu, shehim bekuntrasim k'tuvim mishnei avrehem, ar chumashim, printed on both sides of a page, and any type of printed material, davar pashut hu she'ein yotzin bo, you can't be yotze with a reading of the Torah, v'havalei kakari alpeh, v'afil b'shat adchak, l'evshah be'acher, einem avarech. And if you have no Torah, forced to read from a chumash, you wouldn't say a bracha over that. And the Magen Avraham said, though, v'linira de'bitfilin u'mezuzot pasul, mishum de'ief she'letzamtzem, u'pa'amim she'nitfas ha'ot asheni kodim l'Torah, v'havle shelo kisidrom. So the Magen Avraham does not rule out directly a Sefer Torah, but he speaks about why you cannot mass print tefillin or mezuzot, and not for the reason you think. There's a halacha that tefillin have to be written kisidron, in order, one letter after the other. That's why you can't correct a mezuzah, for example. Can't correct tefillin, because if a letter is puzzle, right away then it's out of order, unless it's the last letter. But the Magen Avraham said, when you're printing with movable type, you don't really know the order of the letters, so therefore it can't be done. But a Torah? Torah might be different. The Magen Avraham leaves that tantalizing suggestion. And he says, Gittin as well, this Magen Avraham in Lamed Bet Nun Zayin Arachai, Gittin, to write a bill of divorce, we learn that Chakikah is kasher b'sefer Torah, k'de'eshkechon b'luchot, ach l'chadchila yesh li zoher, v'chei nagu. That Gittin, theoretically, the laws of Chaktochot means you can't chisel a surrounding area so that letters result in a Sefer Torah. I mean, let's say it's all black, you can't carve out the black to leave and make it white and leave a black letter. But Chaktochot apply only to Tefillin and Mezuzah. They don't apply to a Sefer Torah. The question is printing really Chaktochot? Are you making an engraving in the parchment or the paper? Or is it just ink on the surface? That's an argument. He wasn't that opposed to having a printed get. Chacham Ovadja in Yechavadat in the sixth chelek prohibited it. And the other reasons as well why you would not have a Sefer Torah written, but it's not entirely clear. Other, each Shem Hashem needs special kavana when you write it. You can't do that with a machine. Rav Kook said it needs koach adam. A person has to do it. A human being has to do it. The definition of ktivav, writing, is moving the hand to form letters. And the many other reasons given, you know, when you have many reasons, it means that one reason does not really suffice. Well, could a get be printed then? Also not. Although the Taz argued that printing is similar to writing, but it bears elements of chakika umikal makom linin get vaday ein lasot bitfus kevon shekzad domel chakika. Again, he is dancing around the question of whether printing is more like writing or more like engraving. This taz is in Yeridei and Reish Ayin Aleph Sifka and Chet, but the Ramar Menachem Azariah Fano in his Shut 93 permitted printing a get as long as a Jew activates the machine and the witnesses' names were printed as well, and the Prichadosh and Evanessa Kuf Chafei also permitted a printing a printed get, but we don't do that as well because the opinions that prohibit it. Gittin are written by a sofer. All 12 lines. What about the sanctity? Does a printed work have any kedusha? So the same Taz I quoted before said, "Avolinya kedusha asvarim kol amekil atid litenet adin." Anyone who's mekil is lenient on the kedusha of a chumish, so I have to pay for it. But there is a difference. For example, the Chavot Yoer writes in a number of places that, as we know, a husband and wife are not allowed to sleep together in a room that has a Sefer Torah in it, but the Chavot Yoer permitted a husband or wife to sleep in a room with a printed Svarim, because it's a lesser Kedusha. Could typeset in the Shem Hashem be disassembled, or is that considered erasing God's name? The answer is no, because it's backwards and it's not readable to the Shem Hashem. That's how the printing took place. It's not dissimilar, by the way, to questions that come up all the time now about writing God's name on a computer screen. Can you then delete it? Or are the pixels considered writing? Generally, we say no, because pixels are not ktiva, they're not writing, they're not meant to last, and they have no real substance. Now, one of the most enduring features of a Jewish publication always existed, but also took on new life now, and that is Toot Sofer, the scribe's error. So we see it in the Sifrei Torah, certainly in ancient scrolls. Rav Soloveitchik mocked the Cairo Geniza, saying that you can't bring proof of anything from a Seamus box. I mean, by definition, it's inaccurate. That's why it's put in Seamus. Very often, Jewish practices, texts, davening, the Talmud were affected by mistakes that crept into handwritten texts, but they became much more durable when it was in print. So Gemara says in Baba Batra, for example, the Chafal from an Aleph, they knew about errors. Shabeshto kevon de ol, talking about errors we have ingrained in us from our youth. Once a mistake takes root, it's very hard to undo. And this was noted by Rabbeinu Tam in the introduction of Sefer HaYashar. He said, even though Rabbeinu Gershom cursed kol man de mishamesh Talmud, hachi v'hachi teheve, anyone who makes a mistake in transcribing the Talmud, such terrible things should happen to him. It's one of the charamim of Rabbeinu Gershom. Lo nimnu milashabesh, Rabbeinu Tam says. People kept printing and printing, writing and writing, and making mistakes. Just as egregious, sometimes thinking is a toot sofer, sometimes thinking something is a toot sofer, leads to intellectual laziness. Meaning the student can't figure out what the Gemara means, assumes there's an error, amends the text to conform to his way of thinking, and doesn't know what he doesn't know. If he knew the Svara, he would realize the text is correct, and he is not. There was an era, for example, at JTS, maybe still like that, when this was very much in vogue. Any textual difficulty invariably produced an emendation, whether or not it was warranted. The emendation solved the conflict, but often was completely fabricated. And sometimes you don't know. You don't know, and there's a lot of chachma and derashot and svarot that go into analyzing what looks like a mistake. Maybe it's not. Some say it is, some say it isn't. And I'll give you a very nice example. In the tefillah of Rabbi Nechunya ben Akona, familiar to us from a siyum of any masechet, upon leaving the Beit HaMidrash, the Gemara says, Brachot Daf Chof Chet Amud Bet, that we thank God shesamta chelki miyoshev beit hamidrash losamta chelki miyoshev kranot, thanking God for placing us among those who sit in the house of study and not those who sit in the corners. What's the yoshev kranot? So Rashi explains, one, chenvanim, the storekeepers, or amiharetz, or the simple people that just sit around and talking. But if they're chenvanim, which is how Rashi describes it in Baba Kama Daf Pei Bet, what's wrong with shopkeepers? That we say, thank God that I sit in the Beit Midrash, but I don't sit in a store. What's wrong with the store? This led Rav Kook to suggest that this is a misprint, that really the text read Yoshvei Kuf Reish Vav Tav Karot, which is meaningless, so the printer or copyist changed it to Kranot, which is a phrase in the Talmud, not realizing that it should have been read Kuf Reish Vav quotation marks Tav, an abbreviation for Karsiot v'Teatraot, circuses and theaters, which makes more sense. We thank God for making us dwellers of the Beit Midrash. Losamta chalki, our portion is not miyoshvei karsiot v'teatro, those who sit in circuses and theaters. That does make sense. Very intriguing. Another Rav reject this completely on the grounds, also not unreasonable, that you never find the phrase in the Talmud, circuses and theaters. It's always the reverse. Theaters always come before circuses. Teatrot v'kirsot, but who really knows? There's one halacha that is unresolved that revolves around this such confusion as well, that the Taz and Yehoradea mentions. You know, we have a custom not to eat meat with fish because of sakana. In the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote that ein lechol dagim b'cholav mnei sakana. You're not allowed to eat fish with milk because of the danger. And the Taz says, this is a tot sofer. It's a mistake. We never heard of such a thing. And yet, many Sfardim still have the custom of treating fish and milk like Ashkenazim treat fish and meat. Nonetheless, our respect for the printed word is so profound that we allow printers to assume a disproportionate role in determining our liturgy. Printers. So for example, we all live through this, especially recent during the Yom Naram. There are piyutim that we say in the Machzorim because they're in big print. Others we skip because they're in small print or the back of the Machzor that we really should be saying. Who determined this? It was the publisher of that particular volume. We're assuming his scholarship was such that he knew this is important, therefore big print. This is less important, small print. But who knows? I remember once when I was a rabbi in Queens, we just happened to miss saying Zechor Brit in Slichot on Erev Rosh Hashanah, because we didn't have hadn't printed its Slichot yet. We had the pamphlets. And the pamphlet just said, Zchor Brit, you had to find it elsewhere, and just, I didn't see it, and we missed it. These decisions were made by the publishers. I'll give you another example. In most Sidurim, up to very recent times, in Psukkot Hazeh, and the Psukkot Hazimra, V'charot HaBrit begins a new paragraph, even though it's the end, it's the continuation of the previous pasuk. Umatzata levavo ne'eman lefanecha v'charotim ha'brit with Avram Avinu. Why? Because we say v'charot aloud at a brit. That's the minhag. So some publisher came along and said, well, since sometimes you say it separately, therefore we have to make it a new paragraph, even though you cut off the pasuk right in the middle. Another example. Neman Atah. It's a new paragraph in the Brachot after Haftarah because they used to have piyutim there, which we don't say anymore. But nonetheless, that new paragraph is kept. Here's another example. The Musaf on Yom Tov that falls on Shabbat, coincides with Shabbat. So on a weekday Yom Tov, most Sidurim go from Vahasienu to Kachenu Mitzvotecho without prefacing Elokeinu V'Kevoteinu, except on Shabbat. Then we'll say Vahasienu, V'Martel V'Racheinu, Elokeinu V'Kevoteinu, And the question is, what's the connection between Elokeinu, Kevetenu, Ritzeinu, Nuchateinu? Elokeinu, Kevetenu, that's an introduction to a paragraph, say in any event. Rabbi Yaakov Emden held this was a mistake, a printer's mistake. We should always say Elokeinu, Kevetenu, and then continue Kachenu, because Hasienu, Vasienu does not begin Elokeinu, Kevetenu, unlike the previous paragraph. But a printer wrote Aleph, Vav, Aleph in small print, and Ritzev Nuchateinu, so people thought that only Shabbat requires Elokeinu v'Kevoteinu. All right, others disagree vehemently. The Gra held you never say Ritzev Nuchateinu even on Shabbat, but I think Rabbi Yaakov Emden is correct, and that's how I say it, even on a Yom Tov weekday. Or I'll give you one more example. There's we recite Sheva Brachot for a second marriage only the first day, usually at the wedding. At the wedding meal. But there's an urban myth that you say Sheva Bracha Rashabara for 3 days, the first 3 days. That urban myth is based on a mistake in the Tur that the Aruch HaShulchan points out in Evan Ezra Simon Samech Bet, Sifchaf Aleph. He says the Tur wrote that a widower marries a widow, then no Sheva Bracha just the first day, but if the Panim Chadashot, then you say Simcha Bimono in the benching, the Zimun, and then Asher Bar Mevarchan Kol Gshosha Bizman Simchatom and Omrim, and he brings another opinion that you don't say it. And the Aruch HaShulchan says, no. Boror detot nafal b'divrei haTur. It's obvious. There's a printer's mistake in the Tur. And what they did is they just took this phrase, Asher Bara, which is part of the Yesh Omrim, that you need 10 to say Asher Bara, and he just put it before. So it looks like that's part of the 3 days. And it says, can't be. L'chein to hamagihim. The scribes made the mistake. And he ends by saying, Nira shegamba tur who taught sofer ki yadua shebesifrei hatur naflu harbe toyod. It's well known that there are many, many mistakes in the Tur. And then he says in Sif Chav Bet that even some of the gedolei achronim and those who print the kitzer hadinim, they'll write that you have to say it for 3 days, and it's a mistake. The kar of liat brachel v'atala should not be said. Now, note these mistakes also occurred in hand copied books, but the capacity of printed books to disseminate these mistakes much more widely was exponential. All right, history, just to summarize, moves according to the divine plan. And the 15th century was a time of much turmoil and unrest for Jews, and it would only get worse. Jews would be expelled from the Iberian Peninsula in the 1490s and head east, and then head west to America in the 1600s. But just like the Torah Shebal Peh, the Oral Torah, assumed written form after the second Churban, so that Jews could carry it with them into exile, I submit to you on speculation only, the Gutenberg movable type printing press was up and running when the calamitous exile from Spain occurred. That's the Ratzon Hashem, it's God's will. So Jews could also take Sfarim with them in large numbers to minimize the sense of dislocation, both on a personal level as well as on a intellectual level. So about a century after the Gutenberg's printing press was invented, the Shulchan Aruch was published. Without the commentaries, the Shulchan Aruch is a pamphlet. The 16th century saw an explosion of Jewish books. And as the Jewish world expanded across the globe, the ability of Jews to interact, not just commercially and politically, but also intellectually, expanded as well. And all this was because of the printed word. And if we think about it for a moment, Rashi died in 1104. The Rambam was born in 1135. How many times does the Rambam quote Rashi? None that I'm aware of. Who says he even knew of Rashi? And they weren't that far apart in geography. When Svarim proliferated, and all due to Gutenberg, Torah became even more accessible for those who wanted it. Sure, there are big arguments. Many people were against publishing the Shulchan Aruch, the Marshal, the Ramah, the Maral, because they held that people stop learning. No, every Jew is going to think he's a posek. Look, history did not side with them, and the Ramah made it acceptable for Ashkenazim, but how would they feel about the internet, and perhaps the biggest posek today in the world, the Gadol Hador, Rabbi Google? Like every invention, the value of the printing press depends on, like every invention, the value depends on how it's used. So too with the printing press, which revolutionized the world at large and the Jewish world in particular. I thank you all for your kind attention. Next month and next year, we'll look at how the Renaissance affected and changed Jewish life. I thank you all.